It is gone. A two-run home run for Reese Hoskins. Game over. Bronco wins it.
He got it. Pulled it right out of the bushes.
Swing and a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 237. I'm John Stolness from SB Nation's Phillies blog, The Good Fight. Follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Got a big hot stove show coming up for you here in just a few minutes. Mike Ferrin, co-host of Power Alley on SiriusXM's MLB Network Radio. He's also the pre- and post-game radio host for the Arizona Diamondbacks. Good friend of the podcast. He's going to join us in just a couple of minutes to break down all the big news we've had over the hot stove here in the last couple of days or so. Also, going to talk about the power moves being made all over the National League East. This division is getting really competitive. We're going to look at the remaining pitching options for the Phillies now that they've lost out on Patrick Corbin, and we're going to talk about whether or not Major League Baseball should ban defensive shifting. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But before we get into the guts of the show, I promised that I would read some of the reviews that have been coming in for the Good Fight podcast and for Hittin' Season. And once again, if you have the time and you like me and you like the show and would like to leave a note, go to Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star rating, and if you wouldn't mind, just a couple of sentences of a review of the show. It can be constructive criticism, things you'd like to see changed, but also things you like, and just a general comment about the Phillies and where they are right now. Phillies Fever wrote, "My favorite Phillies podcast. That's so nice. I've been listening to this podcast for a couple years now, and it's always been a constant source for quality Phillies coverage. If you're a Phillies fan or just a baseball fan in general, you'll find this podcast to be entertaining and enlightening." Thank you so much for that. Sammy M534 wrote, "Highly recommended for any Phillies fan. A fun podcast that always provides great insight. They post episodes incredibly frequently, so it's a great way to keep up to date on our favorite team. Highly recommended for any true Phillies fan." And that's it. With Justin and Liz now also doing continued success under the Good Fight banner and the Dirty Inning, and we're doing two shows a week of Hittin' Season, you basically have Phillies content 4 days a week coming at you on the Good Fight podcast feed. So again, if you're not a subscriber, if someone just kind of pointed the show to you or you're listening to the show at the Good Fight, go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is that you get podcasts, and subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed, which is where you will get Hittin' Season, continued success, and the Dirty Inning. All right, let's get into the guts of the show here, and we're going to get right to our guest to talk about some of these big moves on the hot stove. It's Mike Ferrin, good buddy of the podcast. You know him as the co-host of Power Alley on SiriusXM's MLB radio network, and he's also the pre- and post-game radio host for the Arizona Diamondbacks, really taking advantage of that nice Arizona winter, I suppose you could put it in quotation marks. Mike, thanks for coming back on Hittin' Season. How are you enjoying the weather out there, my friend?
Well, I mean, it has been chilly the last couple of days. The highs were only in the 60s, John. So,
oh, heavens.
Today it's back to normal. It's low 70s, but we're making do with that cold snap.
How have you survived? A longtime DCite now out in Arizona. And I got to tell you, man, both of us have some interesting teams right now. The Phillies and Diamondbacks. Maybe looking at the offseason in slightly different ways, but I want to talk about the D-backs here in just a second. But before we do that, I wanted to talk to you first about the fact the Phillies lost out on Patrick Corbin. Signing with the Nationals, certainly not a team I think that most people had in mind at the very beginning of the offseason when people were talking about potential Corbin destinations, but the Nationals emerged with the best offer out there, a 6-year, $140 million deal. I think, you know, you obviously know the Diamondbacks as well as anyone, Corbin's team these last few years. What are your thoughts on the Nats giving him a 6-year, $140 million deal?
I mean, it's a little bit richer than I anticipated, you know, what the market for him would be going into the winter. I mean, clearly he was the best free agent pitcher available. And I figured that, you know, somewhere in that 5-90 range would be about right. So, you know, if you're guessing that, then, you know, you start getting to, that's what, 18 a year. I figured 20 wasn't out of reach. And, you know, 5-100, if you go to 6 years, then you figure it's like 6-120 in that range. So it's a little richer, I guess, overall than what I anticipated. But they're getting a really good pitcher. And I think that's the part I saw some Phillies fans and some fanalists after the fact pointing to his career earned run average and whatnot. But really, since about August 2nd of 2017, you make the case he's been one of the five best pitchers in the National League. I mean, his strikeout rate is, you know, nearly 30% over that time. He doesn't walk anybody. He, you know, he gets a ton of ground balls. I think he's given up 20 home runs in 267 innings in that time, which is a pretty low total. You know, this is a really good, talented pitcher who has a Tommy John on his resume, but has a nearly unhittable slider. And I think the numbers on that pitch really back it up. I mean, he's been an excellent – he was an excellent pitcher this year. I think he's a good bet to give the Nationals a decent value throughout the at least the first half of that contract.
And I think the Nationals were a little bit more encouraged to go that sixth year knowing that the Phillies were lurking. Obviously, you know, with all the moves that have been made in the National League East, which we'll get to in just a minute, the Nationals definitely, I think, wanted Corbin as much for themselves also as to keep them away from Philadelphia. But, you know, it's interesting to me that the Phillies and Yankees, who both need starting pitching, were willing to go to 5 years, but not to 6 years. And for me, I was willing to do 6 years because I thought, if you're going to go five, why not? What's one additional year? But obviously, that one additional year is a big deal to some very smart teams like the Phillies and the Yankees. How do you think he'll age as he gets into his early to mid-30s?
Well, I mean, I think that he's got a couple of things going for him that are you know, pretty good. Not the least of which is that he has excellent fastball command, and I think those guys tend to age the best. I mean, Corbin isn't overpowering with his fastball. You know, for the most part, he'll be 90 to 92 with it, but he works inside to both lefties and righties pretty effectively, and he's able to locate it to both sides of the plate. And really, the calling card is that slider. And maybe that's where some teams, you know, because he has a Tommy John on the resume, you know, that's something that they're more concerned about. Certainly, Washington has a lot of history with guys with Tommy John surgery, and has, you know, they gave Strasburg the biggest contract ever to somebody who had Tommy John surgery.
Right.
So they clearly are more comfortable, I think, with guys who've been through the injury once as to knowing where the limits are, maybe.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that those – I mean, I would assume that the fact that he has some sort of injury history and the fact that pitching is pretty fragile to begin with is what limited teams to going to the sixth year on him. But, you know, Washington has had success with that, and I think Washington's also kind of living in the now in that, you know, their window is kind of open at this moment, and they need to take full advantage of it to try and be able to compete. I realize that they don't necessarily believe in windows as an organization. They want to be competitive year in, year out, but I certainly think that Corbin helps them to, you know, remain in the mix for the National League East.
What do you think this means for any potential pursuit they might have of Bryce Harper? Obviously, the Phillies are rumored to be a big hunter of Bryce Harper. I don't think anything's going to happen until the winter meetings in Las Vegas, his hometown. But you look at the numbers, the financials, and unless the Nationals are prepared to go over the luxury tax, I don't see how they can bring Bryce Harper back. But sometimes you make special rules for special players. Do you think signing Corbin aces them out of the Harper sweepstakes?
No, not necessarily. I mean, they've gone over the luxury tax the last couple of years, too, so I don't think that that's any issue for them. You know, I wouldn't read too much into it to assume X and Y and Z. I mean, I think they clearly felt like going into this winter that they would make a run at Harper. I mean, certainly publicly it's been out there in terms of what the number was that they offered him. It was the 10 years, $300 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty good floor, and I think that their ownership certainly is wealthy enough that they could be able to add Bryce Harper back if they saw fit. I mean, that's a deal that ownership is going to have to make. So I don't think it necessarily takes them out of the running on it. I wouldn't read too much into that and say, well, Team X has a better chance of landing Harper because Washington signed Patrick Corbin. I don't know if the two are necessarily correlated.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've done a lot already in Washington to – you know, now bolster the rotation, add a couple of key relievers that in Rosenthal and Barraclough to help that bullpen, and then beyond that, add a couple of pretty good catchers in Suzuki and Gomes. So I think they kind of have decided to move on their winter, and now they're in a position where they really don't have much more to add. I mean, I guess they could do something short-term at second base until Carter Kieboom is ready.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I think they're probably in a spot where they can kind of sit back and wait and see how the Harper market develops and decide whether or not they want him back.
Yeah, a lot of Phillies fans are kind of panicking a little bit right now, not realizing we haven't even gotten to the winter meetings yet, gang. There's still a million things out there that could happen, but Washington certainly did make them.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the one thing about baseball's free agency and their winter is that, like, we are so attuned to what happens, especially in professional football, where, mm-hmm. you know, professional football is over with quickly. You know,
yeah.
the season is over with quickly. Every
NBA, too.
One game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but you know, the NFL is king, right?
Sure.
And so their free agency lasts an hour. Like,
right.
Where's the fun in that?
Right, exactly. Exactly. No, this is a slow burn here, no doubt about it. And I think it's, you know, and Phillies fans are seeing the teams in their own division making some moves. But the Phillies did make a move this week. You know, they got a good shortstop in Gene Segura. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Segura trade real quick, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the cost of acquisition, it was pretty low for a guy who is that talented. Now, mm-hmm. Segura comes with a little bit of baggage. I mean, I don't think he has always been a favorite teammate or employee in places that he's been, and that probably has some of the impact on why that he was available at that price in terms of the cost of acquisition. But he is a really good hitter, and I had a chance to see him play every day in 2016, and it's an excellent bat. He's not going to walk very much, but he will hit 300 most likely, and he will I think he's a very good second baseman, personally. I think he's better at second than he is at short.
Mm-hmm.
But he's certainly capable at shortstop, and he is a way better option at shortstop than anything the Phillies ran out defensively last year. So very good arm, speedy runner. I think working with Dave McKay the one year he was in Arizona really helped to teach him a little bit about some of the finer points of base running. Max, one of the best base running coaches in baseball, and I think he really helped Segura in that. And I think also be hitting in a ballpark that's a little bit more cozy, you're going to see the home run total go up a little bit. But I could see him being a guy that hits 300 with 15 or so homers and steals 25 bases while playing a solid average shortstop.
Yeah, he was been a 3-4 win player these last few years, and the Phillies got, I think, 0.6 WAR out of their shortstop position last year. So we've talked about it a lot here on the podcast. Definitely a big upgrade for the Phillies, and obviously some more moves yet to come. And I think now that they've lost out on Corbin, looking ahead to some of the other free agent pitching options, there is no ace left at the top of the rotation to go out and get in free agency here, but there are some decent options here. And I was wondering which of these you think is your favorite, Jay Happ, Charlie Morton, Dallas Keuchel, Nathan Eovaldi, or the young Japanese pitcher, 27-year-old left-hander Yusei Kikuchi?
Well, I mean, a couple of those guys have been Phillies in the past, too, and Morton and Happ,
and Happ,
obviously.
Yep.
I'm sure a fan since 09 is going to be thrilled if Jay Happ goes back to the Phillies.
Right.
This is one of the great parody accounts of all time.
Comes full circle, yeah. He's
absolutely compared to Cole Hamels, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
I don't know that I have necessarily a favorite out of that. I mean, I think Keuchel is probably the best pitcher out of the bunch. Morton is not far behind him. Eovaldi has a long injury history. Kikuchi has had some shoulder issues as well. I don't know that I necessarily have a favorite in that, but two things. One, I don't think Patrick Corbin's an ace either. I mean, I think he's more of, where he slots in that kind of 2-3 slot and a rotation is about what he really is. This is number three starter. And I think that people hear that and they go, well, that's damning with faint praise. And not really. I mean, those are plus players. Those are 60 grades on a scouting scale. Those are championship caliber starters. And I don't know that, that's the case, I don't know that there's necessarily a guy in that group that fits that mold either among the free agents. But that said, I don't know that the Phillies really need that. They have their guy who's the front of the rotation guy in Aaron Nola.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think I almost would rather the Phillies be a little bit more opportunistic either on the trade market or in free agency for maybe some guys that you see the value slipping or maybe are a little bit higher risk reward, because I don't see starting pitching as being the biggest need for the Phillies. They certainly could use the depth in the spot, but I don't think that they need to go out necessarily. And if they, you know, just because they didn't get the top end of the market, that they need to get the second best guy on it, because that group overall, I think, is pretty strong. I think Pavetta's a candidate to take another step forward. You know, Velasquez, when he's healthy, has been, you know, pretty good. And I think one of the wild cards is a healthy Jared Eichhoff. And if Eichhoff is healthy, I'm a big fan of his, and I think that that really helps to flush out that rotation. So I think you're probably looking, if you don't get the top guy, it might be a better fit in my mind to be a little bit more opportunistic than to play wading into the deep end of the pool and trying to spend as many of those dollars as you can on fixing the position player base, which was really the issue with the Phillies last year.
Right. I'll just mention one other starting pitching thing before we get to that, because you're right. This team needs offense more than it needs starting pitchers, and needs relief pitchers more than it needs starting pitchers. But outside the free agent market, there's the trade market. We're hearing Madison Bumgarner's name mentioned in connection to the Phillies a lot. And also Robbie Ray for your Diamondbacks. And I love Robbie Ray. I think that would be a really intriguing trade option for the Phillies. Are the Diamondbacks looking to deal a guy like Ray?
No, I mean, I think the Paul Goldschmidt trade talks are real, and so were the ones that involved the Phillies in that, by the way. That was, you know, there were some legitimate discussions there. I don't know that they got particularly far, but there was somebody that interested Philadelphia for sure. I think, you know, this is a little bit like we have forgotten, because we've seen so many teams, when they start trading established players, just make the assumption that as a result of that they're going to go through a full-blown rebuild. And that really isn't the case, to my understanding, in Arizona. It's more of what you would have seen, you know, 7, 8, 10 years ago, or where you have a mid-market team that has a superstar player who's not willing to give a hometown discount, in part because he already gave a pretty sizable one in his last deal, and has a high power agent who's going to be a free agent after the year, and the team is trying to maximize their return on talent for him. So I believe that, if you know, that it is most likely that Goldschmidt is the only one of the prominent Diamondbacks players that are under contract who gets moved. Obviously Corbin left via free agency, AJ Pollock's a free agent. But unless somebody were to, on Zach Greinke's no trade list, were to make a deal where they were willing to take on the bulk of that contract and give up talent, you know, I don't see him getting moved. I think Robbie Ray stays. I think David Peralta stays. I think Nick Ahmed stays. And, you know, I think if they're out of it in July, then some of that gets revisited. But I don't see Robbie Ray as necessarily being a trade candidate right now, unless, of course, someone were to come in and blow them out of the water. If, you know, Rhys Hoskins were offered for Robbie Ray, I think Phillies fans would probably have heart attacks, but I think that that would be something that they would consider at that point. But again, I you know, obviously that's not going to happen. And I think Ray is probably, even though he likely has the most trade value of any of the guys on that roster right now, I don't necessarily see him as moving at this moment.
Right, and you mentioned Greinke. The Phillies are on Greinke's no-trade list, so that looks extremely unlikely to virtually impossible. But last thing I'll ask you here, Mike, is we're talking about position players. There are obviously two position players, of which have been closely linked to the Phillies. I think most Phillies fans feel like the offseason's a failure if they don't get one of these two guys, Harper or Machado. Simple question. When the winter meetings are all said and done, do you expect either one of them on the Phillies? And if so, which one?
Well, I don't know if they'll be done by the end of the winter meetings. I don't necessarily think that. Although there would be, it would be within Scott Boras's ability as Bryce Harper's agent to understand the spectacle that would be Harper signing a free agent contract at those winter meetings in his hometown. I mean, that would be pretty cool, but I don't know that it necessarily, do we have to tie it to that. I felt all along that Machado was the most likely. He seemed to be the guy that they coveted, you know, leading up to this point, knowing that they were, you know, trying to put themselves in a position to be able to, you know, add during this, you know, crazy great free agent class this winter. Machado has ties to the front office, and that, you know, Andy MacPhail and Matt Klentak were both in Baltimore when Machado was drafted number 3 overall. You know, you're talking in about an elite bat who plays premium defensive positions at either shortstop or third base, who's just now entering his prime. I think, to me, Machado is still the guy that is number one on their list and would be the guy that is most likely of the two to sign there. So, to me, it's Machado is I will believe that Machado is signing with somebody other than the Phillies when he actually signs with somebody other than the Phillies. Huh. Until that point, I'm working under the assumption that Philadelphia is going to get him.
Very interesting. That would make a very, very nice left side of the infield, but then the Phillies would have to go about getting some help for the outfield. I'm a big Michael Brantley guy if the Phillies get Manny Machado. I love what he would bring to that outfield from an average standpoint and offensive standpoint, getting on base, a little bit of power mixed in there too. That would be a terrific combination. But
He would be good. I would throw A.J. Pollock into that mix, too. I know the Mets are interested in him, and mm-hmm. Pollock has had some injury issues you know, that have limited him in the past. But he's you know, from Jersey, you know, so he's an East Coast guy, and I really think he would be a tremendous fit for the Phillies. He would help solve a lot of the ills on both the offensive and the defensive side from that group. So, you know, I view him as being a guy that would be a potential upgrade for them as well. And, you know, would be a really nice add. You know, maybe not quite as reckless as Aaron Rowan, but similar in terms of the skill set to what Rowan brought.
Yeah, we love Rowan. We just don't want anybody breaking their faces from here on out. You know, let everybody keep their faces the way God intended them to be without ramming them face.
Plays hard, but I don't see him doing the Aaron Rowan break your face.
Good.
I mean, listen, like for all of the nicks against Pollock, you know, the injury that he suffered this year was a broken thumb where he was diving for a ball at a game where his team was down 6 in the ninth. So if that doesn't tell you that the guy wants to play hard, like that's, you know, I mean, doesn't that play in Philly, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like that guy never feels like he's out of a game. And I don't know. I have a personal affinity for AJ. I just think he's a really good person. He's a really good player. You know, he was one of the early adopters of the there's no slug on the ground. Mm-hmm. He's a great student of hitting. And he's got the, I don't know if I can say this on your program or not, he's got the ass in the right way.
I love it. Yeah, you bet.
He's just wired as such that he's a really competitive dude. I'm a big AJ Pollock fan as a person and a player, and I think he'd be a tremendous fit in Philadelphia as well.
So many options to improve this team, and the Phillies have to keep improving because the rest of the division is improving around them. But as we're getting into the hot stove here and getting into the winter meetings, no better person to talk to about it than Mike Farren. You can follow Mike on Twitter at @Mike_Farren. Listen to him on Power Alley on Sirius XM's MLB Network Radio. And also, if you're in the Arizona area, the pre- and post-game radio host for the Diamondbacks. Mike, thanks so much for coming back on Hitting Season again. I appreciate it.
This ball is out of here.
Well, just after my conversation with Mike, the Diamondbacks finished a trade of Paul Goldschmidt to the Cardinals, who are clearly going for it this year. This is a big deal. 3 years missing the playoffs in a row, I guess, is motivating for St. Louis, I suppose. They're giving up Luke Weaver, Carson Kelly, Andy Young, and another piece. Now, none of these, as far as I'm concerned, are players that St. Louis will really miss a whole lot. Luke Weaver is a middle reliever / starting pitcher who struggled mightily last year. Think of him akin to the Phillies' Zach Eflin. And then with Carson Kelly, he's a young catcher who has a good future in front of him. Didn't do all that much when he was up at the big league level last year, but he's still blocked by Yadier Molina. And then Andy Young is an infielder playing in single A. I think he'll be in double A this year. A very good looking young player, but none of these are elite prospects. And that's what the Cardinals gave up in order to get 1 year of Paul Goldschmidt, who they now hope to sign to an extension, or they're at least hoping that he'll enjoy playing so much in baseball heaven that he won't be able to help himself and will want to get a contract extension with the Cardinals this year. The Cardinals think that simply playing in St. Louis for the Cardinals organization means that players are going to fall all over themselves to sign extensions. And hey, maybe Goldschmidt will, but you know, this is a 32-year-old guy who is going to be in the last year of his deal, making $14.5 million. He, with another good year, probably has one more big contract left in him. Maybe that'll be with St. Louis, but We remember the Phillies were rumored, as Mike mentioned just a second ago, in trade talks for Goldschmidt last week. And I think the Phillies could have offered a very similar package to this, but I think the Cardinals liked the fact that there was a young catcher in this deal in Carson Kelly, because I think the Phillies certainly could have matched up these kinds of prospects. Zach Eflin as the lead in a Goldschmidt deal seemed a little off kilter when we first heard it last week, but now we see the Cardinals trade, and yeah, that makes sense. It's just I don't think the Phillies had a catching prospect like Carson Kelly. I mean, they have Jorge Alfaro, but they're not going to trade Alfaro for Paul Goldschmidt here. So I can understand why the Diamondbacks went with St. Louis's offer here. And frankly, Goldschmidt at first base would have been a lot of fun. It would have been really cool, but it wouldn't have solved the Rhys Hoskins in left field problem. So, but here's the thing. The Cardinals just got a lot better. And they're going to move Matt Carpenter to third base, which likely takes them out of the Machado-Harper sweepstakes. So that's good news for the Phillies. That's one less team that they're going to probably be vying to compete with to sign Harper or Machado. But the Cardinals just made themselves a lot better. They got a middle-of-the-order bat that they haven't had since Albert Pujols left. And so now here's another National League team that, if you're talking wild card, that you have to watch out for. And the Cardinals are loading up just like the rest of the teams in the National League East. The National League East and National League Central are going to be crazy good next year. It looks like the balance of power is clearly in the National League right now. And we're not even done seeing the moves, because we fully expect the Phillies to get a whole lot better here over the next few weeks or so. Some of these moves made over these last few days have been eye-opening. Of course, the Nationals signing Patrick Corbin. And really, like I said to Mike, I think some of this was to keep him out of Philadelphia as much as it was to bring him to Washington. But listen, give Brody Van Wagenen and Mike Rizzo credit. They're keeping pressure on the Phillies and Braves in the National League East. And this division looks like it's going to be involved in a multi-year war with all of these young players the Phillies and the Braves have, and the young players the Nationals now have, too. We were looking at the Nationals as a veteran team whose window was closing, but you have in Juan Soto and Victor Robles two outfielders who could be all-stars for years to come, and Carter Kieboom, who's going to be their second baseman, probably, if not midseason, he'll be a September call-up, and he'll definitely be the guy in 2020, but that is a stud-looking prospect as well. And then you have that front three of the rotation with Scherzer, Strasburg, and now Corbin. That's dynamite. That's a really good baseball team. I think at the moment the Nationals are probably the favorite in the National League East, with the Braves right there. The Mets made themselves better by trading for Edwin Diaz, although it is kind of fun that the Phillies' interest in Diaz basically forced the Mets to give up two of their very top prospects in that Diaz-Cano deal that they made with Seattle. As far as the Nationals getting Corbin, look, it's an overpay. 6 years for $140 million is an overpay. I would have been okay with the Phillies giving Patrick Corbin 6 years and $140 million, and I know that I'm in the minority on that. I do. I know most folks did not want to give Corbin that kind of money. I think Corbin's going to be really good. I think he's going to be a pain in the butt. I think he's going to beat the Phillies a number of times over these next few years, because I think his stuff is good. I'm not that worried about all the injury concerns of pitchers who throw a lot of sliders. I think Corbin's going to do well for Washington, and I think he might not pitch well the last 2 years of his deal, or even the last 3 years of his deal, but the Nationals want to get to the World Series before Scherzer and Strasburg are too old to do it. Before they lose Anthony Rendon if he doesn't sign a contract extension. You know, they want to get there. They've been so close so many times and haven't been able to do it. This is a deal that they made for the next 2 or 3 years to keep that window open. And the Braves won the National League East last year. They already have a great team, and they added Josh Donaldson and Brian McCann. And they could still strike and get Michael Brantley or A.J. Pollock, or even they could make a trade for a starting pitcher. With all of the prospects they have, they could go get one of Cleveland's starters very easily. We've heard Pollock rumored to be heading to the New York Mets. We just heard Mike talk about A.J. Pollock. He's talking me into Pollock a little bit as a guy you would want in your outfield. The Mets are not laying down here. This new GM of theirs, Van Wagenen, is aggressive, and he's pushing forward. Frankly, he's acting like a general manager of a New York-based baseball team should act like a guy who has money to spend and like a guy who plays in a major market. So I give him credit for doing that. I think all more power to the Mets. The Mets are going to be better. The Mets kicked the Phillies' butt last year. The Phillies finished ahead of them in the standings, but when they went head-to-head, New York looked like the better team, and you still have DeGrom, and you still have Syndergaard, and it looks like the Mets might go out and get another starting pitcher as well. Now, the Phillies have added Gene Segura. And if you heard my Patreon bonus podcast, you heard me do the full breakdown on that Segura trade. I also wrote a piece about it for The Good Fight, talking about how Matt Klentak really did win that deal. But it's clear, given some of the moves going on in the National League East, the Phillies really need to add Harper or Machado. And I still think they need a closer-type reliever, and another starting pitcher would be helpful, too. I think that that's what's going to happen. But the pressure's on the Phillies a little bit here because the National League East is not conceding this division to the Phillies' pocketbooks. And so they're going to have to go out, and they're going to have to do what they promised, and that's they're going to have to spend some money, and they're going to have to get good players in here to compete in a suddenly revitalized National League East.
This ball is out of here!
Well, with Patrick Corbin now on the Washington Nationals, the Phillies' attention will focus on a few other names if they want to improve the starting rotation. And I guess I am a little bit surprised that they're going after starting pitchers with this much aggressiveness, but I think they look at last year's starting rotation and they see in Aaron Nola that they have an ace. And Jake Arrieta is a guy that disappointed last year. He was a disappointment, and obviously we're hoping he bounces back somewhat here in 2019, but I don't know that we can be sure that that'll happen. And with Pivetta and Velasquez and Eflin, you have young guys with lots of promise, but who were up and down. Clearly, the Phillies front office wants to find another starting pitcher that can provide some stability and some upside in the rotation. Somebody that you can put after Aaron Nola in the rotation and reasonably believe that you're going to be able to get your team on a winning streak by having those two guys going back to back. So we've heard a lot of the different names that are still available, and basically the Phillies have been connected to virtually all these guys. Jay Happ is a name that we are all familiar with, of course, drafted by the Phillies, came up through the farm system, made his debut in 2007. He's now 36 years old. It really is amazing the career that he has put together. He went 7-0 with a 2.69 ERA and 11 starts after being traded to the Yankees last year. He was a 20-game winner a couple of years ago. He's frankly turned himself into one of the most durable left-handed starters in baseball. He routinely gets guys out. There's nothing flashy about him, but he's deceptive. He has always been deceptive, and he's a good starting pitcher. The problem is he's 36 years old, and he's probably going to want a 3-year deal. Now, Jay Happ seems like the kind of guy who might age like Jamie Moyer. I think there's a possibility Happ pitches into his 40s, like Moyer, and is effective doing so. So a 3-year deal for Jay Happ is something I would do. It's not nothing I'd get super excited about, but it'd be something I would do. I would more like the Phillies to go after another former Philly, Charlie Morton, 35 years old. The last 2 years with Houston, he's gone 29-10 with a 3.36 ERA and 55 starts. He would also require no draft pick compensation as he was not given a qualifying offer. Jay Happ would not either because he was traded midseason, so he was not eligible to receive a qualifying offer, so no draft picks for either guys if the Phillies were to sign them. Morton is a guy Klentak has already signed before the 2017 season. Or was it before the 2016 season? Yeah, it was before the 2016 season when he blew out his hamstring in his second or third start with the team. But Klentak saw something in him and in his ability. And when he was with the Phillies in those first few starts, he was throwing hard. I remember being surprised. What is Charlie Morton doing throwing 96 miles an hour? Well, he carried that over into Houston, and Houston turned him into the pitcher that he is. I would love to see the Phillies sign Charlie Morton. He's probably, of all the free agents, the starting pitcher I would be most excited to see the Phillies go after. Probably number three on my list here is Dallas Keuchel. He's just 31. He won the American League Cy Young Award in 2015, but he has been up and down these last few years. He had a 4.55 ERA 3 years ago, went down to 2.90 the following year in their World Series season, and then last year it was 3.74. He fluctuates. He's not terribly consistent. He did throw 200 innings last year. He always ranks among the league leaders in poor contact, but we had a lot of Phillies pitchers high up in the rankings of poor contact, and because of their bad defense, they didn't get the benefit of that poor contact, and that's my worry with Keuchel. If they don't fix the defense, if this defense does not improve by some large measure, A guy like Keuchel is going to be wasted here in Philadelphia. I just don't think he's going to be a fit here. I think Keuchel's going to go to the Yankees, frankly. I think that's a perfect fit. Keuchel going to New York, and I think the Phillies will land either Happ or Morton. That's my prediction. Now that Corbin is off the board, I think the Phillies sign either Happ or Morton here at some point. And maybe it doesn't occur until we get closer to January or February when some of these pitchers are looking at the market and realizing that it's not shaking out the way they thought it was going to shake out. Another possibility is a Japanese left-hander, 27-year-old Yusei Kikuchi, went 14-4 with a 3.08 ERA last year. Has a 2.58 ERA over the past four seasons over in Japan, but of course we know Japan's league is a little bit less competitive than the majors. It's basically in between AAA and the majors, so a quad A type league. And he also has had, as you heard Mike mention a few minutes ago, some injury issues during the course of his life, during the course of his season career. Not life, not season, career. I just don't know much about this guy. I can't say whether or not he'd be a great fit. He wouldn't cost a whole lot because the new posting rules basically puts every team on an even playing field to sign him. Everything you hear is he wants to play on the West Coast. So, again, I don't think that Kikuchi is going to be coming to Philadelphia. And then there was a pitcher who I believe will be no longer available as you hear this podcast. Nathan Eovaldi and the Red Sox seemingly close to a contract renewal, somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 years and maybe $60 million. That's way too much. I'm glad the Yankees are going back all in on Nathan Eovaldi because I have never been a fan of Eovaldi. He had a great postseason last year, did some heroic things for Boston, but I don't think he's a dependable major league starter. He's an injury risk waiting to happen. I also don't think he's got a great fastball, throws 100 miles an hour, but it is straight as an arrow, and hitters do line him up on a regular basis. So I'm not a Nathan Eovaldi guy. I'm glad Boston is going to take him off the market and bring him back. Makes sense. He was a postseason hero for them, so good for Eovaldi going back to Boston. And, I think the Phillies missed out on Corbin. They only went 5 years. They only offered a five-year deal for Corbin. Again, I think if you're going to offer a guy a five-year deal, what's one more year if it means getting a guy you really want and not letting him go to the Washington Nationals by chance? But, I would have signed Corbin to a six-year, $140 million deal. And I know people like to throw eggs and rotten fruit at me whenever I say something like that, but I would have done it. That's the price of doing business in free agency. That's the business we've chosen. I didn't ask what the price tag would be because it had nothing to do with business. But and I'm sorry, a little godfather there. But, I think Corbin at 6 years, $140 million would have been a great addition, slotted right behind Aaron Nola. I'm disappointed that it didn't get done. He would be younger at the end of a six-year deal, Corbin would be, 34 years old, than Happ or Morton are right now, which is another reason why I would have gone 6 years for Patrick Corbin. And hey, listen, it could turn out that last year was a one-hit wonder, and he stinks, and the Nationals are stuck with a horrible contract for an underachieving pitcher. I don't wish bad things on people, but I kind of hope that happens because it would make me look stupid, and I'm fine with looking stupid as long as it means the Phillies didn't miss out on a potentially great pitcher that they could have had in their starting rotation. Now, there are a couple of trade possibilities out there, and there probably will be some additional pitchers whose names come up at the winter meetings that we're not talking about right now. We just heard Mike talk about Robbie Ray and how it doesn't seem like he is a candidate to be moved, which is a shame because he has a 3.93 ERA and a 1.15 ERA plus, has struck out more than 30% of hitters over the last three seasons. But you've got Madison Bumgarner. We're hearing more and more conversation about the Phillies being connected to Bumgarner. 29 years old, made 21 starts last year, a 3.26 ERA, a 3.99 FIP. His 19.8% strikeout rate was down from his 23.9% career mark, and his walk rate of 7.8 was up from his 5.8 career mark. He'll earn $12 million next year. As I mentioned on a previous podcast, when I was laying out my initial offseason plans and I advocated for the Phillies to trade for Bumgarner, I think he's a bounce-back candidate. I like him as a 29-year-old guy in the last year of his deal, motivated to get another big free agent contract, motivated to be playing with a good baseball team. The San Francisco Giants were a going-nowhere team last year, and the injuries were fluky. You know, you hear it's himself on his ATV. He gets hit by a line drive. These aren't like chronic elbow shoulder problems, soft tissue injuries where you always have to worry whether or not Madison Bumgarner is going to be able to take the ball. I think Bumgarner is a guy that would help, would look really, really good slotted in behind Aaron Nola in the rotation. It just depends on what it would cost to get him. If it costs to Adonis Medina, I probably do that. Most of Twitter disagrees with me. I put out a tweet asking people if you would include Adonis Medina in a deal for Madison Bumgarner. I got close to 1,000 responses. 52% of you said no. 48% said yes. So most of you do not want Adonis Medina in a Madison Bumgarner deal. Then you don't want Madison Bumgarner because that is likely what it would cost to get him. The Phillies could also go after one of the Cleveland starters. I'm not sure the Phillies have enough to get, I'm pretty sure they don't have enough to get Corey Kluber. Carrasco and Bauer, they probably could work something out. I just wonder about how painful it would be and whether or not it wouldn't just be worth signing a free agent. You know, if I'm going to trade for a starting pitcher, it's got to be a young, controllable guy. I'm not giving up, with the exception of Medina for Bumgarner. I would give up Medina probably for any of the Cleveland starters as well. So I'll just lay that out there. I think Medina is the Phillies' big trade chip. They have to decide if they want to use him for a hitter or if they want to use him for a starting pitcher. But that's the ace in their pocket right now that they can play is Medina, because they're not going to trade Sixto Sanchez. They're just not. We heard this week that the Phillies considered including Sixto Sanchez in a deal that would have gotten them Edwin Diaz in with Gene Segura, but then it decided not to include him because they didn't want to give up Sixto Sanchez for a relief pitcher, which is smart. I think that was the right decision, as much as I wanted Edwin Diaz to be on the Phillies. But I would use, it would have to be some very special player for me to include Sixto Sanchez in any kind of deal this offseason. And I'm one of those people who's not averse to moving Sixto, given all the injuries he had last year. I'm not sure, he's not a slam dunk to me that he's going to be a great pitcher in this organization. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope he'll bounce back this year because the talent is certainly there. It's the health that I question. But with Adonis Medina, the Phillies have a guy who is there as their number two prospect or their number three prospect, their second best pitching prospect. You can use him as a guy and mix in some of your big league surplus to go out and get a Cleveland starter possibly, but or go out and get another hitter. But it remains to be seen how the Phillies want to allocate those resources. It's good that they didn't have to use any of them in the Gene Segura trade. They still have everybody. That's a big, big plus. But I think at the moment, right now, Adonis Medina for Bumgarner or one of the Cleveland starters is probably as far as I would go. Clear the Phillies want to do something to improve the starting rotation. And while I do like Pivetta, I do think he's going to have a bounce back year, or not a bounce back year. I think he's going to take a big step forward this year in 2019. I think Velasquez had a better year than people remember last season. And I think Aaron Nola will continue to pitch well. This team probably does need at least one more solid arm. And so it's clear that's their modus operandi right now, is to go out and get that arm as we wait for the Harper or Machado shoe to drop here over the next couple of days.
This ball is out of here.
All right, one last thing before we get out of here, and it's been the talk of baseball this week. A piece by Jason Stark of The Athletic where he talked about a growing sense around baseball that there is support that the shift will be banned in some capacity. Either that or drastically altered. Stark reports that at last month's owners' meetings, baseball's competition committee gave the commissioner strong backing to try to put something in place to limit shifts. That's according to sources who spoke directly with members of the committee. And there were some interesting statistics in this piece that Jason wrote. There were 8,000 more shifts on balls in play last year than the year before, according to Sports Info Solutions. 8,000 more shifts. There were fewer ground ball hits last year than there have been in any season since baseball expanded to 30 teams in 1998, and over 1,200 fewer than we saw as recently as 2015. There were also fewer singles last year than in any season in this millennium, and nearly 3,000 fewer than just a decade ago. And they postulate why. A number of people inside the game, including members of the competition committee, some members of the competition committee, have concluded that teams and hitters have reacted to the shift by saying they're going to hit the ball over those shifts, which we're talking about the launch angle revolution now. They've also concluded that the uppercut swings are fueling the tsunami of strikeouts, as Stark put it. And finally, they've concluded that teams are never going to react to the shift by saying, see where nobody's standing on the other side of the field, let's hit it there. The shift's been around for a long time. Hitters cannot adjust that way. And I've seen a lot of people on Twitter respond that way. Well, hitters just have to learn to hit the ball where the shift ain't. They can't do it. You can't. That's not how baseball works. You can't do that. It takes a very special skill set to be able to place the ball that precisely and still be able to generate power. I mean, if you want a game where guys are just slapping balls the other way, you could probably have that game, but it's going to be boring as hell. You can't, it's not possible for some hitters to just hit it where they ain't. If it were that easy, everybody could do it. Everybody would be Rod Carew or Tony Gwynn or Wade Boggs. It's not that easy. It's a very special skill set, especially as pitchers are throwing harder than they ever have before, with nastier breaking stuff than ever before, with relief pitchers. Every relief pitcher in a bullpen now is throwing 95, 96, 97. There are no more rubber-armed 88 to 90-mile-an-hour guys anymore. And so that's the problem here, is you're combining great stuff from just about every pitcher you face with extreme shifting. Now, you can't ask hitters to hit the ball. You can't ask Anthony Rizzo to hit every pitch in the shift every time, hit a ball to the left side of the infield. He's going to have 5 home runs at the end of the year if he does that. You just can't do that. So here's the problem. It's like, what's to blame? Is it the shift? Is it the launch angle? Is it the fact that the baseballs aren't juiced last year like they were the year before? Will shifting actually help? That's the big question we need to ask ourselves. Are the shifts actually going to help? Well, here are some numbers. Last year, there were 9,096 balls hit into a shift. 2,034 of them were hits. With no shift, there would have been about 500 more hits last year across baseball. But here's the thing to remember. Those 500 hits would have been spread out over about 2,400 games. So that would only come to about 3 extra hits in the entire sport per night. For the average team, it's about 17 more hits a season. So we also have to remember that all of these different hits we're talking about are singles. And singles, as Stark mentions in his piece, have never been less impactful than they are now because strikeouts are way up. So you get a single, the next two guys behind you are likely to strike out. They're not going to put the ball in play. That's why teams are talking about slugging percentage and hitting home runs and hitting doubles. That's why the Phillies focus so much on slugging percentage, is because they know trying to string together 4 singles is hard, especially when you're facing a guy like Max Scherzer, or you're facing the number 4 starter who throws 96 miles an hour with at least 1 good breaking pitch. So what's the solution here? I hear people saying, well, if you ban the shift, then you got to ban sliders and you got to ban this and you got to ban... That's baloney. You can ban the shift. And I'm fine with banning the shift. I'm all for banning the shift because I aesthetically hate it. I've always found it aesthetically unpleasing. And I do think it takes its away. I watched Ryan Howard hit one ground ball after another into the damn shift. There are some hitters for whom the shift more drastically affects them. Ryan Howard was a 300 hitter. Until the shift came along. He really was. You look at his stats, he had a 300 season, over a full season, because he would hit so many balls into that right field hole. Now, you might not get, you know, if you take the shift away, it's not going to be, you know, you're still going to be able to position 2 infielders on one side, 2 infielders on the other side, so you might still be able to get more outs than you would have 10 years ago, but certainly not to the point now where you have a guy standing in shallow right field scooping up ground balls that for a century were base hits. And that's what I find aesthetically displeasing about shifting. And we saw Jake Arrieta complained about it this year because, frankly, it didn't help the Phillies this year. And we've seen other teams like the Cubs. They don't use extreme shifting, and they have one of the best defenses in baseball. We see other teams. They don't use extreme defensive shifting, and they have good defenses. Some teams that use extreme defensive shifting use it well, and they do it well. And it's possible the Phillies, when they were looking at spray charts, were looking at too small a sample size, and so where they had players positioned was not accurate. But regardless, it doesn't sound like getting rid of the shift is going to result in a whole lot more hits, and it's not going to necessarily generate a whole lot more action. You might just have a couple of singles per night here and there go through. But maybe you can bring back the hit and run in baseball if you don't have defensive shifting. the argument that I have with people who are against banning defensive shifting is you hear, well, if you ban defensive shifting, it's not going to help the offense all that much. Well, conversely then, having a shift doesn't negatively affect the offense all that much. So why are we doing it? Why are we doing it? If getting rid of it wouldn't make much of a difference, then having it doesn't make much of a difference. So who cares at the end of the day? Seriously, what is this argument we're having? If you believe in defensive shifts, then you have to take the position of these really help teams. These cut down on so many hits and they save so many runs. This is a big deal. If you took shifting away, you would radically affect the game. You would radically affect how many runs are scored. And frankly, I would take the other side of that. I would say, yes, more action, please. I don't care about games being shorter. I care about games being boring, about there not being enough action. And so that's what everybody's trying to figure out how to get their arms around. How do you bring more scoring back into the game without everything being a strikeout, walk, or home run? I mean, I don't know that we necessarily need to have baseball like it was back in 1987. But clearly, they're trying to figure out a way to get more action into baseball. And I'm fine with getting rid of defensive shifting because I don't think it helps all that much. I don't think it does all that much. I think it hurts more than it helps. I'll be perfectly honest with you. And if it helps, it's minor. Not enough so that if you were to mandate that you can only have two players on the right side of second base and two players on the left side of second base, then so be it. I don't understand the warm embrace of defensive shifting to the point where people are vehement about it. That's just not where I'm at. Just not right. And it would, as Stark mentions in his piece, doing something like banning defensive shifting or radically altering it would at least show the fan base that Major League Baseball is getting the message that the game needs improvement. I don't know that I want them to make a move that just to send a message. It's got to be good for the game. And that's the most important thing. Will getting rid of defensive shifts be good for the game? I think it would probably be better for the game than not. But at this point, I'm fine with them doing it. If they keep defensive shifting in, it's not a hill I'm going to die on. I don't like it. I don't like defensive shifting. And I would like to see it go away. But if it sticks around, fine. Because I don't think it has a whole lot. It really affects things all that much. Unless you're like the Phillies last year when maybe they were using it improperly, and hopefully that's one of the things they're going to take a look at this offseason. And when they utilize defensive shifting next year, hopefully Jake Arrieta and everybody else will be much happier with the results.
This ball is out of here!
And now it's time for your stat of the week. Scott Lauber noted this stat after the Gene Segura trade. Over the past three seasons, Gene Segura got 538 hits. Only six players have had more hits over the last three seasons than Gene Segura. You've heard of these guys before. Jose Altuve, Charlie Blackmon, Mookie Betts, Nolan Arenado, Francisco Lindor, and Manny Machado, MVP candidates, elite baseball players all. Gene Segura is not at that elite level, but that tells you all you need to know about his ability to put the bat on the ball and have that ball fall safely somewhere in the field of play. What a quaint idea. Folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Mike Farron for coming on the podcast. If you haven't done so, gang, please make sure to head on over to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and a review. Thank you so much for all of you who have done that over these past couple of weeks. It definitely helps the podcast. And subscribe if you're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. Also, check out the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittinseason. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll talk to you all next time right here on Hittin' Season.
Hello, I'm Spencer Hall from SB Nation, and I want to tell you about my new show, It Seems Smart. It Seems Smart is a show about people doing things that, for some reason or another, seem smart at the time. Those things might include doing a little cocaine and driving a bike up a mountain, or I don't know, maybe racing 100 miles per hour across the country in the middle of the night with no one's permission. Or even stealing a bat from an umpire's room in a Major League Baseball park. Check it out, and if you like it, tell a friend. I'm Spencer Hall. Don't do anything smart.